This is The Guardian.
Today, if you knew when you were going to die, how would you choose to spend the time you had left?
Today in Focus is supported by Rainforest Trust. In honour of this year's Earth Day, we're promoting Rainforest Trust's Brazilian Amazon Fund throughout April. Rainforest Trust is a 501c3 organisation, which means that 100% of all money donated goes directly to conservation efforts. The fund has already helped protect more than 6.5 million acres of rainforest habitat, but Rainforest Trust still needs to protect a further 13 million acres to reach its goal. You can help. Donate online at rainforesttrust.org/earthday this April, and your generous gift will be quadruple matched for the Brazilian Amazon.
Before we start, I want to let you know that in this episode, we mention suicide and we discuss cancer surgery in detail. At the end of the episode, I'll give you the details for Samaritans who can offer you support should you need it.
The thing that hangs over all of this, I think, is this strange idea that there's a date in the diary that you're going to die.
I mean, it's like jumping off a cliff. It's not natural. It's not a natural thing to do. For people who aren't depressed and don't want to end their life, it's not a natural thing to do. You're literally standing at the cliff edge and you're going to jump.
Paola Mara was diagnosed with bowel cancer in 2021. She had several invasive treatments, but the cancer kept spreading aggressively. She got to the point where she couldn't tolerate most pain relief medications anymore, and she couldn't face the prospect of palliative care.
The quality of life will be terrible. I'll be in hospital constantly. And I said, I don't want to do that.
Paola decided to take what control she could of her death. Because assisted dying's illegal in the UK, she would fly to Switzerland and, with the help of the organisation Dignitas, end her life there.
Yes, I go on the 18th and then I die on the 20th. But I don't feel negative about it at all. It's funny, I don't even really see it as an ending. It's just a part of my life.
She wanted a record of how she felt in the last few weeks as she looked ahead to a decision she felt she shouldn't be having to take. And she recorded a series of conversations with The Guardian's social affairs correspondent, Rob Booth.
Well, I've been reporting on the assisted dying debate in England and Wales for a few years, and the stories of people who are actually wrestling with the current laws in England and Wales and the UK generally are the ones that I think probably need to be heard more than any others in this debate.
We're the ones who are dying. We should be the ones who choose how to die.
The majority of people in the UK want the law on assisted dying to change.
The campaign group Dignity in Dying conducted the largest ever survey of people's views. It found that 75% of people in Britain supported a change in the law on assisted suicide.
And politicians are promising to consider it.
I'm personally in favour of changing the law. I don't want to make this a party political issue. It needs to be cross-party, and I will make time available if I am Prime Minister.
From The Guardian, I'm Hannah Moore. Today in Focus, could the UK change the law on assisted dying?
So I didn't know what to expect when I walked up to Paola's house. It was a really smart little house in North London.
Hello.
Hi, Paola.
Yeah.
Very nice to meet you.
You too.
I'm Rob.
Hi, Rob.
Yeah, hi.
She answered the door, full makeup, smart hair, beautiful long black dress that she was wearing.
Yeah. And you'll meet Stanley.
Who's Stanley? Oh, the Whippets.
No, the Whippets.
Inside, just absolutely immaculate, beautifully designed, and there was fantastic art on the walls, lots of it. Really good paintings, actually, of greyhounds and Whippets, because that's a big passion, or has been a big passion in her life, and she'd done a lot of charity work with those in the past.
I started a fundraising thing for Whippets, and then I ended up having a Whippet hotel. That sounds crazy, doesn't it?
Where, here?
No, in Cornwall.
I did look up her website for the Whippet hostel. It looks so good.
Who's that, Stanley? He's old now, bless him. He's going to back to live in Cornwall.
Is he?
Yeah. So he will retire in Cornwall on the beach.
Lovely.
Yeah. He's going to have a nice life.
And it's a lovely, warm home. And we sat down to talk.
I'm originally Canadian. I came over in 1989. I had been traveling and I basically ran out of money here. So I stayed. And I was able to stay because my grandfather is British. He's from Manchester.
Paola struck me as someone who's always known how to enjoy her life. You know, she was something of a rebel when she was a kid, her brother told me. She worked in the music industry and she had all sorts of friends. And she was slightly... anti-establishment edge, stylish, and fun-loving.
A friend and I both love Alexander McQueen.
Yeah.
Well, she's 56, 53. We just thought, fuck it, let's get tattoos.
Yeah. Is it a McQueen sort of skull?
It's just a little skull.
It's just a little skull.
But I got it done there as a final fuck you to cancer.
How long has she had cancer for?
Well, she had breast cancer in 2017, which was when she was about 46. And she had treatment for that. But it appears that they might have missed the fact that she also had bowel cancer at that point. And so she was diagnosed, I think, 2020 with bowel cancer. And she had chemotherapy for that during the COVID year. Really, really rough time.
There was a point where I think it was about 8 months that I didn't see anyone.
Yeah.
Except Uber drivers and my chemo nurses. It's bad. It was really bad.
And at some point, did it become clear then that her illness was incurable?
That's right. It developed from stage 3 bowel cancer to stage 4 bowel cancer in 2021, which is when it was clear that it wasn't going to be cured.
I had something called Krukenberg tumors, which are quite rare. I think only about 4 to 5% of women get it because it's an ovary. It happens to your ovaries. Oh. And they're famously hard to treat.
Yeah.
So the chemotherapy was just the start of a lot of grueling surgery and treatment that she had. She had most of her bowel removed. She had this huge operation involving the removal of a lot of her organs and their replacement with very invasive chemotherapy.
So they remove everything. They put your organs back in that are non-cancerous. They fill your cavity full of chemo. They heat it up to, I think it's 45 degrees, and oscillate your body for, I think, 2 to 3 hours. With the chemo inside you. And that surgery caused a lot of damage. Like it permanently damaged my bowel.
Yeah.
Bowel cancer is not easy.
No.
And she described as well the kind of panic and suffering that she had. She said she had 6 nighttime emergencies. She lives on her own when she had to scramble to get to hospital because of problems with her bowels and blockages and so on. So it was very, very clear that she had already gone through an incredibly grueling experience.
Mm. And why did she decide that she wanted to just end treatment and take control of ending her life?
Well, she knew the struggle that she was going to face towards the end of her life, or the good chance that she was going to face an extreme struggle. Her treatment had left her unable to take all sorts of powerful pain-killing medications. So the alternative options of palliative care were quite limited to her.
Because I've known people who have passed away through bowel cancer and they've really struggled.
Yeah. So you knew what was ahead of you.
Yeah. And I don't want to say too much because I don't want to scare people, but I don't want people to think when they die they're going to be in pain with bowel cancer, because I think some people can be managed with drugs. I can't. The way I will die will not be a good death.
She talked to her medical team about it, and she had given them a strong indication of what she wanted to do, and she felt that they didn't disagree. And so, taking all these things together, she decided to take control of her own destiny in relation to her death and to try and avoid the worst of the suffering. I mean, she said that she wasn't afraid of dying, but she was afraid of dying in pain. And it was in the first part of this year, I think January, when she actually set the date with Dignitas.
What process did she have to go through to get approved for that?
So you have to join, you have to become a member, you have to pay money. I mean, the whole thing's ended up costing her about £15,000. A lot of paperwork she talked about. You know, they wanted to see, original long-form birth certificates, her divorce certificates, medical documents. It was quite arduous. I mean, she said, look, at one point I was worried that what if this paperwork doesn't come through and I can't get this done?
She's still ill and I'd imagine has kind of limited reserves of energy as well.
Yeah, increasingly. But yeah, lots of admin. I mean, for example, she even had to arrange for an undertaker to come from the UK to fly to Switzerland to bring back her ashes to the UK.
Because you're not allowed to send human remains through the post or any kind of UPS. So you have to have a human do it. And apparently there's quite a lot of paperwork. So again, I didn't want to put that on anyone. So I just hired, I think his name is Richard. He seems a lovely man.
He's going to go over to Zurich.
He's going to go pick me up.
Pick up the ashes and bring them back.
And so she's been having to plan all of this stuff because she can't do it here.
How did she feel about making that journey to Switzerland?
She said it was really unfair. That's her quote, really unfair, that she couldn't die at home in London or, you know, anywhere else in Britain. She'd lived in Cornwall before. She'd lived in Suffolk before. She loved the beach down in Cornwall. She felt it was really unfair that she couldn't do that here.
And how many people are in a similar situation to Paola? How many people are going from the UK to Dignitas every year at the moment?
Well, I think since 1998, over 540 people have gone. So I think that works out at around, it's sort of 30 odd.
Okay, so a considerable number of people.
Yeah, and that really understates the situation. I mean, I've done stories with other people who had planned to go, had joined, but didn't go because they couldn't in the end, or, you know, they felt the cost was actually too much. So the demand is much greater than the people who actually make it all the way out there.
And, you know, when you were speaking to her, did it seem like she'd considered what it would actually be like to be there on the day and to end her life?
She had absolutely thought about that. I mean, there comes a moment on the day when you, when the day that you're assigned to die, sounds strange saying it, doesn't it? When you have to take your own life with the help of Dignitas, but you have to do it yourself. So there is a moment when you have to do that. And she had thought about that, and she wasn't 100% sure about how she would feel about it, but she said that it would be in her character to try and get it over with quite quickly.
That bit is the bit that's going to be hard. And right now, again, it's an idea. It doesn't feel real. But it, in my mind, and knowing what I'm like, it'll be like a see you later.
Yeah.
It's completely unusual to have a date for your probable death. What did she want to do with the time she had left?
Well, she said it was, she had the exactly the same feelings that we would all have and that you've just explained, that it seems odd, weird. But what she did do was use that kind of calendar to focus on living more.
I am spending the time that I have in the way that I want. I am going out and doing things. I just came back from Soho Farmhouse with three beautiful friends, and we've had a really fun time. I've put on 2 stone because I literally go out for tea. I was at Sketch yesterday. I sound like a bit of a wanker going out to all these really posh places, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't have any kids to leave money to, so I'm like spending money on going to these like really beautiful restaurants and like just going out.
Your diary is full.
My diary is actually full, and it's hard because there's people who want to get in there, and it's like it's full because I have a date.
Yeah.
You know, and she was wrestling with these funny things of kind of, you know, she talks about, I want to clean the cupboards out in my house before I go. And she said, I know that sounds strange. I said, it did sound strange. And she explained that, well, she wants to leave the place in good shape so her brother can come and over from Canada and stay with his family in the house over summer. So she was thinking about life after her death as a part of her life.
How have her friends and family felt about this decision?
Well, I spoke to Tony, who's her elder brother who lives in Toronto. He said that he was originally in sort of denial when she first joined Dignitas, couldn't really think of it as a, you know, a reality.
It's so odd. It's we're brought up with this idea of someone dying in your life in a bed for, you know, a long period of time and people sitting, holding their hands. And this goes against that. This is like a, you know, a specific minute. The person, you know, it's very odd. It's contrary to what we're brought up with.
And does it feel okay to you?
Yeah, it does. It does now. I mean, I still hope she's okay. I hope she's not lonely in going alone. And we've talked about that. I mean, I think that my immediate reaction was, oh, I'd want to be there for her, but. Yeah, she used the excuse, though, you could get arrested if you go back to the UK. And, you know, she did say if it's really important to you, come on over. But I don't necessarily need anyone.
Why did she want to be alone?
She just wanted to. She wanted that peaceful time, I think, towards the end where she could just, you know, gather herself and get on and do it.
A lot of people are kind of horrified that I'm going alone, but to me, it's not. It's not an awful thing. I'm kind of quite looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And having some peace and quiet and, yeah. Hanging out on a lake with some fondue.
Rob, we made an episode of Today in Focus a couple of years ago about assisted dying, and I spoke to a man called David Minns, who was terribly ill. And he was campaigning for the government to change its position. Where has the political debate on this got to now?
It's moved on quite a lot since then. Keir Starmer has recently said that he will, under a Labour government, arrange time for there to be a free vote in Parliament on this topic. It seems likely that the same thing would happen if Rishi Sunak remained Prime Minister. 2015 was the last time there was a vote in Parliament, and assisted dying was defeated pretty heavily.
Mm.
There was an attempt to get a private member's bill through in 2021 that ran out of time, but it really feels like it's much more likely to come to a free vote in Parliament now. And the parliamentarians who are campaigning for it, such as Kit Malthouse, believe that, you know, they're starting to get close to getting the numbers to win.
Right, okay. So that really would be a huge shift.
It would be a huge shift. And I mean, it's looking like we're going to have a general election, which is going to change the makeup of Parliament quite considerably, a lot of new faces. You know, and that could cut both ways, because we might end up with a lot of parliamentarians who haven't given this huge amount of thought yet, and they will want to give it more thought. So it's not going to be a fast thing, but it's moving in that direction.
And it would be a free vote, because this is, well, a lot of politicians over the years have said this can't be a party political issue.
That's right. Starmer has said it will be a free vote. So he's not going to whip his MPs to vote any one particular way. It'll be a matter of conscience and how parliamentarians feel that they're best representing public opinion in their constituencies.
Right.
And public opinion consistently seems to hover around 70% in favour of assisted dying, but with strict controls.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So obviously, if the law was to change, people are very concerned that there be safeguards to stop people who are ill or not of completely sound mind being manipulated into this? Just what kinds of safeguards would there be in place if the law was to change?
So the likely proposal of a law would be that assisted dying would become available for adults who have got 6 months or less to live, that they've got a kind of settled view of what they want to do, that they are of sound mind, that they've got the mental capacity to make that decision, so they're not cognitively impaired. And then they could only do so after two doctors independently confirm the situation is within the law and a judge. So a fair number of controls there. So not children, not people with mental health problems. It would be terminal illness only.
And even with those safeguards in place, the strict way in which this law would be written, some people who oppose assisted dying say, well, what's to stop that law being loosened over time?
Well, I mean, this is a debate happening in Canada at the moment, where assisted dying is legal and has been for a little while. And there have been moves to extend the parameters of assisted dying to minors, to children who are suffering awfully, and people with mental health problems. Now, neither of those things have happened yet. In fact, they've been put on the back burner in the parliamentary system there. But critics will say, you know, it's the slippery slope argument, that what were initially conceived of as guardrails would come to be seen as restrictions on human rights. And you say, well, that person's suffering, they're allowed to have an assisted dying. This other person's suffering is not allowed to have assisted dying. And that could be open to court challenges. But really, the Supreme Court in Britain in, I think it was in 2014, was asked to consider whether the current assisted dying law was against the European Convention of Human Rights. The court said this is a matter for Parliament. It's not something that the court wants to get involved with. The thing that would probably inhibit the slippery slope happening is whether Parliament would want to change the law or not. And we've seen that Parliament changing the law on this subject is something that happens very slowly and with a great deal of deliberation.
Mm. And how do doctors seem to be feeling about this at the moment?
It remains quite difficult for doctors to talk about this, I think, in a way, because it's a criminal offence to assist anyone with assisted dying. So if you start talking about the fact that you're for it, then you're likely to bring scrutiny on yourself. And the institutional doctors' bodies have adopted now a neutral position. So they've moved from opposition, I think, to a neutral position. And the medical lobby is one of the key lobbies in the debate. There are now quite significant campaign groups on both sides who are getting ready for this parliamentary battle, this public debate, this national debate that is very likely to happen in the next few years.
What did Paola think of the arguments against legalising assisted dying?
Well, I talked to her about the objections to assisted dying that we've just been discussing. I mean, and she sort of seemed a bit nonplussed by them, actually. You know, her view was kind of, what's it got to do with all these other people? This is about her life and our lives and wanting to have some sort of control over how that goes. And she also said, actually, on the coercion question, that she felt that some people were being coerced by their families to live for longer than they'd actually want to.
I've seen people suffer because they take more treatment than they actually should. I mean, I have seen it over and over. It's either the family wanting the person to stay or the person wants to stay for the kids. If anything, it's the flip side of what you're talking about. So I think it just needs to change.
Coming up, Rob and Paola's final conversation.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Rob, since you first met Paola, I know you've spoken to her a few times, what was your last conversation with her like?
I spoke to her the day before she took her own life in Switzerland. We had a Zoom. She was in her hotel room.
Hi, Paola. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. I can't see you. Can you see me?
Oh, yes. Hang on.
She booked a room in this hotel overlooking the Lake Zurich.
Do you want to see my terrace, though?
Yeah, give us a little tour. Oh, wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
And she was really pleased with the balcony, but she was not as pleased with the 1980s decor that was inside,
right,
inside the room.
And how does it feel being at the hotel?
Everyone wants me to say something really profound.
No, I don't. I just interested.
It just feels like I'm at a hotel with really weird food.
And she was in pretty good spirits, which is kind of sounds a really weird thing to say, doesn't it? But she was.
Was it a hard day yesterday leaving the house?
It was manic because I was obviously, it's like moving house but never coming back. So, you know, throwing away all my toiletries and, you know, just, it was just weird. It was a bit weird.
Yeah, I can well imagine. And then what, jumped in a taxi and headed to the airport?
No, my friend actually took me to the airport, which I don't know if that's allowed or not officially, but I won't tell you her name. So she picked me up and it felt like a Thelma and Louise moment. It was fun, actually, strangely.
I mean, I asked, you know, does anyone in the hotel know why you're there? And she said that she doesn't think so because she hasn't had any pitying looks from them because that's what she's used to seeing.
Right.
She says whenever someone finds out you've got terminal cancer, they tilt their head to one side and give you a certain look. And she says she hasn't seen any of that.
So she's just in a hotel with other people who were there on holiday or business trips.
Yeah, that's right. And she'd hoped that it was going to be quite a peaceful time there, sort of sitting by the lake. But she was getting inundated with, like, you know, social media messages.
The amount of messages I'm getting, I'm actually struggling with. It feels like everyone wants a piece of me. That sounds horrible because I would want a piece of them in reverse, but it's also very hard. And then there's the, not guilt, but the kind of like I feel obliged to respond because I want people to know, you know, how much they mean to me and how much whenever I talk about my friends, I always start crying just because they're so important to me. I want to have that engagement with them, but like I'm just not functioning normally anymore. So I'm struggling. I mean, I'm dying. Well, of course I'm not functioning, but I think I behave like I'm functioning. So people don't realize that. I'm so tired. Like I'm riddled with cancer. Of course I'm going to be exhausted. I don't accept that though, because I'm stubborn.
And does that feeling like that and feeling less well since we talked to 10 days ago, well, a week, just 10 days ago, does that help you feel, yes, I'm doing the right thing here?
What, being in Switzerland?
Yeah, taking your life in Switzerland.
Yes, it's absolutely the right thing because the pain has gotten much worse since I last spoke to you. I can feel my insides starting to go. They're starting to twist and kink and block and do all the things that they always do. It's absolutely the right time. I mean, my oncologist has always said to me, look, I can't give you a timeline of death, but I can sort of give you a timeline of when things will start going wrong. And that's what he did. And he got it pretty spot on.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got the timing. You've done a real good job on the timing, Paola.
Yeah.
You seem pretty calm and settled to me. I don't know. It's hard to read.
Yeah, but I kind of feel like I should feel something more, but I don't. I'm kind of ready. bowel cancer has been brutal and nonstop. So it's like, I just feel ready. I know I keep saying that, but I do. Should I feel something more? I don't know. I mean, the thing that makes me upset the most, and I break down every time, was talking about my friends and, you know, having to say goodbye to people. But the rest of it, I can live with or die with. Like, I can deal with leaving.
Rob, what's it been like for you personally getting to know her a little bit? And how has it made you reflect on death and dying?
Well, I think obviously I've thought about this quite a lot because, you know, seeing her has had a big impact on me, and her frankness about everything has kind of helped close the gap between life and death in a way.
That makes sense.
You know, she's a 53-year-old woman in the prime of life. Her, you know, mental capacities were absolutely there. She had an incredible friendship group. She was successful, popular. And she didn't want to sort of decline and become completely dependent on other people, I don't think. You know, she wanted to be who she was. And a sister dying for her was a way of reaching that goal.
What's the rest of the day bring?
A lot of napping. Probably some more weird foods. I have no idea what it is that I'm eating.
No fondue on the menu?
I did not see any fondue. I might have to actually take a taxi to a fondue place.
That sounds good.
I think I might have to do that for dinner, maybe.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to post it just for you. If I find some fondue, I'm going to do a story.
Paola Mara died last Wednesday. She was 53. You can read her interview with Rob Booth at theguardian.com. If you've been affected by what you've heard today, Samaritans are there for you any time of the day or night, and it's free to call them. Their number's 116 123, or you can email them jo@samaritans.org. That's it from us. I'm Hannah Moore. This episode was produced and sound designed by Eli Block. The executive producer was Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. 6 factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.